Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
College sports are a booming business. Division I schools like the University of Texas and The Ohio State University rake in hundreds of millions of dollars off of their athletic programs, from television rights to merchandising, concessions, and other money streams. But student-athletes don't share in those profits. Here's basketball player Shabazz Napier speaking in 2014 before winning an NCAA championship with UConn.
We're definitely best to get a scholarship to our universities. But at the end of the day, that doesn't cover everything. We do have hungry nights that we don't have enough money to get food, and sometimes, needed money is, money is needed.
Now, California legislators are trying to change the economics of college sports in their state with the Fair Pay to Play Act. If signed into law, the bill would go into effect in 2023 and give college athletes in California the right to receive money from endorsements and likeness rights. Versions of the bill have already passed in California's State Assembly and Senate. Joining me now to discuss is Andy Schwartz, an antitrust economist specializing in sports economics, who consulted on the Fair Pay to Play Act. And he's also the founder of the Historical Basketball League, the first professional college basketball league. Andy, thanks for being with The Takeaway.
Well, thank you for having me on.
So you consulted on the writing of this bill. How exactly will the Fair Pay to Play Act allow students to make money?
The idea is that what the NCAA does when it gets all of its schools together and agrees not to allow athletes to receive third-party payments is that's an economic cartel. And what the California bill essentially says is it doesn't say anyone has to pay anyone, but it says it's against California law to prevent that from happening.
I'm going to imagine the response from the NCAA has not been a positive one, but how have they responded so far? And do they actually have the ability to prevent California-based teams from participating?
The official NCAA reaction was that Mark Emmert, who's the president of the organization and who is paid around $2 million, sent a sternly worded letter threatening that if California schools were forced to follow California law, that the NCAA would not allow them to compete in national championships. Schools themselves have said softer things like, gosh, we really want to follow California law, but the big bad bully in Indianapolis won't let us.
Let's take a step back here. I mean, what are the economics for these college students? We heard at the top here, sometimes, the athletes have hungry nights. These athletes are coming in often with scholarships. What do the economics look like for these athletes?
I feel like there's a step you need to take before asking about the economics, which is what are the rights? And if you come into this with the presumption that athletes are full citizens, like Shabazz Napier was right. He was both blessed to get a scholarship, and he was also being exploited by not getting his full value. And that's an important economic difference. College athletes, especially elite college athletes, are worth far more than the NCAA cap. They can get a full scholarship. In the last 5 years or so, they can now get cash payments of about $5,000. And they can get $0 on top of that for their name, image, and likeness. And essentially what this bill is getting at and what the general idea is that unless an athlete's name, image, and likeness rights are worth zero, capping it at zero is exploitive.
We talked a little bit about the NCAA response, but there are colleges like USC, Stanford, and the University of California system that have come out against the law, particularly over concerns that California teams will end up being barred by national competitions. What's your response to some of their concerns?
Well, I'm a proud Stanford graduate, but on this one, Stanford is really shaming me in the sense that universities in California should be all for empowering Californians to be entrepreneurial and to maximize their potential. And what the schools here are essentially doing is agreeing with a system that's exploitive. It's a very self-interested and really cynical effort, I think, to continue a process that has limited athletes' real rights.
Do you expect the NCAA to appeal to the courts? I mean, how, and if they did, how might they argue their case here?
Yeah, so I'm an economist, not a lawyer, but I like to play a lawyer on the radio anyway.
We'll take it. We'll appreciate it.
There is a concept in antitrust and in the Constitution, the Interstate Commerce Clause, which essentially says that states can't make rules that overly regulate interstate commerce. And I think there's an important distinction here, which is that what California is doing is not, in fact, regulating interstate commerce, but deregulating it. It's saying Californians have a right to certain activity, and that what the NCAA does, which is that it restricts commerce, is not legal in California. And an example would be California has a higher minimum wage than the national minimum wage as well, and that's not seen as restricting commerce. And so that's the difference here, is that by liberalizing or loosening the rules, as crafted, the law should survive that sort of challenge. But with all litigation, if, you know, the NCAA can sue, it'll go to court and we'll find out.
What about at the federal level? I mean, is the concern you mentioned, you know, California is in many ways, as we've covered on this show, an outlier when it comes to its policies. But California is a massive economy and could set the tone for how other states react to this. Andy, do you see that happening?
Yes, I think there have been efforts in other states. I testified in both Washington State and in North Carolina. Neither of those happened for different reasons. Washington, because it felt it was too small to act alone, and North Carolina, because the schools essentially co-opted the legislative process. But with California doing this, and with the three-year grace period that's built into the law, there's room for other states to get on board and essentially draft in the wake of California's economic heft. On the federal level, it's been actually quite encouraging. This ought to be a bipartisan issue. As long as you believe that athletes are American citizens with rights, then if you're a Republican, one of those rights should be the right to be a full participant in a free enterprise system. And thankfully, at least one Republican in North Carolina, Representative Mark Walker, has recognized that. And he is pushing a bill in the U.S. Congress to essentially say the NCAA cannot restrict name, image, and likeness rights. On the Democratic side, in the Senate, Senator Chris Murphy is making a big push. He's put out several white papers and is building towards legislation, as far as I know. And this is a real change from when I started studying these issues in the 90s, where Republicans and Democrats, for different reasons, both saw the idea of athletes deserving full rights as a non-starter.
Andy Schwartz is an antitrust economist specializing in sports economics, and he consulted on California's Fair Pay to Play Act. Andy, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And here with me now to weigh in on the act are Fran Fischella, an ESPN college basketball analyst and former basketball head coach at Manhattan College and St. John's University, and Joe Nocera, a columnist with Bloomberg Opinion and author of Indentured, the Inside Story of the Rebellion Against the NCAA. Really looking forward to this conversation. Thanks to you both for being with us.
Thanks for having us.
Happy to be here.
Joe, let's start with you. Before we even get into the California law, how did amateurism, the model for amateurism in the NCAA, even come about?
Well, you have to go back to the 1950s, really. A guy named Walter Byers, a young 29-year-old former sports writer, became the president of the NCAA. The big problem back then was payments under the table and so on and so forth. And he began to enforce in a very tough way no pay for the athletes. And to the point where Kentucky, of all places, was suspended for a year. And so, you know, ever since then, amateurism has been the gold standard. It's been the thing that the NCAA has always said distinguishes the college game from the professional game. And it is the NCAA's view, which I strongly disagree with, I might add, that if you were to pay the players, if you were to get rid of amateurism, that college basketball would be destroyed, that people would turn away from it, and nobody would watch it.
Fran, I want to get your thoughts on that. And before even getting into that, I mean, let's be honest, college basketball, college sports, NCAA games are a huge business. What is the argument for not paying the people who are actually playing, Fran?
Well, I'm of two minds on this, Tanzina. I live in this world, both as formerly a coach and certainly now as a broadcaster who's on college campuses. So I definitely see that there should be an opportunity for Andy Schwartz used a key word when discussing this with you, and he said elite athletes. And I definitely think for elite college athletes, most notably recently Zion Williamson of Duke University, who was the number one pick in the NBA draft. For the elite college athletes, I think there needs to be a means that they can capitalize on their celebrity, if you will, their likeness, their images. And I think this California law certainly moves in that direction. And I also think that the NCAA, my sense is they are also recognizing this major issue. The worry I have is that we paint a broad brush of college athletics by just thinking that it's only the Duke universities and the Alabama football programs. Having been at a place like Manhattan College, I saw that most college programs operate in a deficit. And so I would worry about the idea of paying a young man at Manhattan College, or a young lady for that matter, on the basketball or volleyball teams. So I know that Joe has thoroughly vetted this and he's written about it. I am of the opinion that there are so many things that the NCAA has started to do over the last decade or so to improve the lives of college student athletes. And can they do more? Absolutely. I think, Tanzina, one of the issues with the NCAA, and I brought this up with them, they are horrendous public relations people. They do not explain all of the things that I think going into being a student athlete at the college level.
But Fran, let me interrupt right there, because I didn't go to an elite school. I went to a state school. But when you're talking about these different schools, I mean, why should there not be payment for students depending on where they're playing? I mean, Joe, you were shaking your head, you know, about that. Like, what do you
think about that idea? Shaking my head. Well, you know, the way it should work is the Manhattan Colleges of the world don't have to pay athletes. You know, it's just like you can pay them or you cannot pay them, but there's no rule against it. And actually, it would make college sports much less corrupt. I mean, we've had this big college basketball corruption scandal. Well, that's because they're sneaking money under the table. If you put that same money on the table, you have a much cleaner system. I would say, you know, there are 65 Power Five schools, as they're called, the big schools. They're going to want to pay. You know, and the West Texas States, they're not going to want to pay. And that's fine. It was not going to change the college basketball tournament. It's not going to change football. It's not going to change anything except that you're compensating the people who are doing the work. I want to say one other quick thing. Basketball and football players are the only students on campus who are recruited for the sole purpose of making money for the university. That's why they're there. That's why they get in the school. And so the idea that they should, you know, be satisfied with a scholarship when they're worth so much more and which they're making the coaches like Nick Saban $10, $11, $12 million is ridiculous.
Fran, your thoughts on that?
Let me push back, Joe, because much of the stuff that you've written about, I obviously agree with. And I do think there is this opportunity for us to change the system as it has been in place, as you mentioned, for a very long time. I would say, and I had this conversation with a major college coach last year, what the average fan doesn't know is that the young man who is not going to play in the NBA, one school told me that they spent per basketball player, is the world I operate in, they spent $150,000 last year on that young man's tuition, room, board, books, scholarship, cost of attendance, travel, equipment, medical, academic support. And so right off the bat, that's a pretty hefty, and that's a $600,000 investment in that young man over the course of 4 years. Schools can now pay for kids to come back to the university and finish after a pro career or any other kind of career. So on the one hand, I think that the scholarship is actually worth something. In many cases, these young kids get into a college that maybe they couldn't have gotten into to begin with. Now, having said that, when we're dealing in the world of the elite athlete, I definitely think there's a way for us for those young people to be compensated. There's no question. But where I have a problem with the NCAA is they've done such a poor job of explaining to the sports community what it is exactly that these young people get. And by the way,
Fran, why do you get to decide that $150,000 a year is what that athlete is worth. I mean,
people have
an economic worth.
I want to
get into that, Fran. I want to hear your response in just a minute, because I want to get into the who is being recruited here, because we are talking primarily about football and basketball. And we've covered the sort of inequality that plays out in sports, particularly increasingly pay-to-play sports across the country at all levels. And often these kids are young Black men who aren't coming from elite backgrounds, who are being recruited, Fran, as you said, and coming in with scholarships, right? And I wonder, Joe, if you think that there is some sort of exploitation going on, whether that's classist or even, you know, race-based for these players. Fran, I'd love to hear your thoughts on that too. But Joe, what do you think?
I think there's a ton of exploitation going on. First of all, you know, many of them major in eligibility. I remember Sean Battier, who was a terrific player and had a long pro career. He told me that the reason he majored in religion in college, it was the only serious subject he could take that didn't interfere with practice. He didn't really care about religion, but it was serious. So many of these players major in eligibility. They get injured and there's no medical care after they get out. Many of them don't have degrees. And they have a job. 50 hours a week on their sport. And everybody else around them, all the white coaches and Black coaches and athletic directors and conference commissioners, they're making millions and millions of dollars.
Fran, what do you think about that?
You know, I think some of what Joe just said was ludicrous because, respectfully, Joe, I coached at Manhattan College. I coached at Providence College. I coached at St. John's. I coached at Ohio University, Ohio State, various levels of Division I basketball. The young men that I coached and recruited at Manhattan College, for example, a small school in the northern Bronx, probably could not have gotten into Manhattan College, and they were primarily African-American kids from the New York area. They probably, in many cases, they would not have gotten into college on their own if we were just considering academics. So we know when college admissions programs vet an application, it's not just their academic strength. It's a variety of things. Every one of those guys graduated. The vast majority of college athletics at Division I are not the Alabamas and the Dukes and the Kentuckys. It's the Boston U's. It's the Ball States. It's the Western Michigans. And it's been my experience that the opportunity to go to college, given the fact that most of those kids are never going to be professional athletes, is an incredible investment in their futures. And is there some of that majoring in eligibility going on at some powerhouse basketball and football programs? I'm sure there are. But the simple fact is, I have been part of a system that has helped educate young men who, like me, I was the first in my family to go to college, have gotten an opportunity to go to places like Providence and Ohio State and Manhattan College. And so I'm in favor of adjusting the rules for the elite athletes, but I also think the value of a college education, both in that classroom, on the court, and on the campus, is a lot more valuable than I think some people tend to make it seem like.
I just want to say quickly, you keep talking about the elite athletes, but it seems to me one way to solve the elite athlete problem really is to do what the California bill says.
It's name,
image, and likeness. And it doesn't always have to be. I could imagine, for instance, the car dealership in Hartford going to the Connecticut women's team and saying, "We want to do an ad with you." You know, that seems perfectly plausible.
It's the Olympic model. But let's talk about that, because let's round out the segment, really coming back to what this is about, because we're talking here about endorsement rights and likeness rights and the ability for these athletes to actually make those types of deals. I mean, Joe, do you think that if athletes were paid for those endorsement rights, that would change the nature of college sports?
I don't. In fact, I think it might have one good effect, which is it might keep some of these freshmen who are jumping to the NBA after their freshman year, might keep them in college longer because they're making some money and they don't have to worry as much and they don't have to worry about feeding their families.
Fran, what about you?
Agreed. And I do like most of the aspects of the California law. And I think We'll see the Rice Commission, which, you know, was put in place after this basketball scandal, move in that direction. I when I hear exploitive, as someone who has lived in this world for 40 years, I want to just scream at times because of all the young people I've been around who valued the opportunity to have college paid for free and have all the other ancillary benefits that come with a scholarship. And again, I can be of both minds on this. And that's how I feel about it now.
I just want to point out very quickly, when I first started writing about this 7, 8, 9 years ago, to call for players to be paid was such a minority position. People thought you were crazy. The California Assembly passed this bill 72-0.
And on that note, Joe Nocera is a columnist with Bloomberg Opinion, and Fran Fraschella is an ESPN college basketball analyst and former basketball head coach at Manhattan College and St. John's University. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.